In the late 1800s, Chicago was a city on the move. They had already had 300,000 people living in Chicago by that time. They were definitely one of the largest sort of downtown centers, with large sweeping brick buildings towering above the sky. They were basically the center of meat processing for all of the Midwest and all of the industry and jobs that came with that. And it was just going to be a few more years when they were going to be awarded the World Fair, which meant that they were going to have 27 million people visit the city. Chicago was doing it. Chicago, though, they had a problem. They had a really big problem. Sewage. Poop. Heather said, don't say that word. I was like, I'm going to do it. It's Street Fair Sunday. Yeah. Something the city's got to figure out, right? And by the 1870s, they had not figured it out. All of the waste from the city and all of their processing, it all went right into the Chicago River, which flowed out into Lake Michigan, which was the source of their drinking water. It was so bad, in fact, that in over an 8-year period, they had 2 different cholera outbreaks, and the second of which killed 5% of the city's population. They knew something had to be done. So they met with their brightest engineer, a guy named Ellis Chesbrow. And they said, Ellis, what are we going to do? And Ellis had a great idea. Ellis said, what we're going to do is we're going to go 2 miles out in Lake Michigan, and we're going to make a dam, and we're going to dig a hole for our fresh water, and we're going to tunnel it right underneath the lake all the way into the city, and the sewage will never reach it, which was a good idea. But by the time it was finished, Chicago had tripled in size, and all it took was one solid rain, and the plan did not work anymore. Well, Ellis, what are we going to do? The council members asked him. He went away and he came back, and he asked for a meeting with the town council, with the city council, and he sat down and he asked them a ridiculous question. He said, okay, let me get this right. He said, our waste goes into the river goes into the lake, and the lake is the source of our drinking water. That's right, Ellis. He said, okay, I got a question. Why can't the Chicago River flow the other direction? Which was an absolutely audacious, really kind of foolish question to ask. It was met with a good amount of mockery and derision, because rivers flow the direction that they flow. Rivers flow into larger lakes or oceans or seas. That's just the way nature has set it up. But Ellis had an idea. Ellis, he wanted to reverse the order of existing things. He said, what if we do this? What if we dig a trench, basically from Lake Michigan all the way to the subcontinental divide, which was 30 miles to the west of Chicago, which was the high elevation point that made that river flow to the east and to the south? What if we dug a deep trench and we went all the way past the subcontinental divide and we released the dam, then the water by gravity would flow all the other way? What if we reverse the flow of the river? Well, for good reason, this was met with a lot of skepticism. It was a tremendous undertaking to be able to dig that far and move that much dirt and soil, shovel by shovel or machine load by machine load. But Ellis was like, I think it's going to work. And so in 1873, they started the job, and they began to dig, little by little, shovelful by shovelful, machine by machine, dynamite where necessary. And for 8 years, sometimes working even through the night, they dug that trench all the way past the subcontinental divide. And then the day came. They called one of the council members. They gave him the honor of pressing the button that would destroy the dam, that would then see if the river would flow in the other direction. The council member got up, prepared to press the button, and it should be noted the council member's parents had both died in the cholera outbreak. And as he stood up, put his thumb on the button, he announced historically, "Let her go," and pressed it. When all the dust and dirt and noise settled, the people crowded the banks of this trench and watched. For the first time in thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, if ever, the Chicago River began to flow west rather than east. The product of years and years of hard work and labor, this culmination of a bunch of really, really small acts, had finally paid off, as now the order of existing things had been reversed. And still does to this day. The river flows west rather than east. It is a wonderful, dramatic, beautiful, wild thing to reverse the order of existing things when people say it can't be done. But it is also a daunting task. It's something that requires a certain amount of cleverness. It requires a little bit of ingenuity, for sure. It requires work, absolutely. And it requires a vision and a confidence enough to ask the question that others may think is foolish, because it's never been done. But more than all of that, more than each and every one of those things, it takes a certain kind of hope, an audacious hope, a hope that in some sort of way, in some sort of sense, dares to ask the questions that others may see as foolish, and yet one day reverses the order of existing things. And one day rivers flow the other direction. In our scripture passage for this morning, Jesus tells us a story known as a parable. And over the past maybe 4 or 5 weeks, we've been right in the middle of the Gospel of Luke. And when I say Gospel of Luke, to say that a book from the Bible like Luke is called a gospel, that just means that it's one of the 4 books that tell the story of Jesus' life: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Luke is one of those stories, one of those books that tell, here's what happened in Jesus' life, as a very sort of particular focus. And this part, right in the middle of the Gospel of Luke, it's somewhere that the author of the Gospel of Luke took so many of these parables and stories and he clumped them all together. So much so that sometimes you're reading 2 or 3 at the same time, all told in one little portion. And every time that we've talked about one of these parables recently, I felt an obligation to tell you what parables are, how we are to understand them and read them, because it's not obvious. And what happens in a parable is that Jesus told, in some senses, familiar stories of familiar situations, but stories that never end the way that people thought they were going to end. Stories that would decenter people, confuse them, upset them even. Stories very much designed to get people to ask a question that might seem foolish at its outset. Jesus told parables to disrupt and confuse and ask questions because Jesus wanted people, he wanted them to begin to ask the questions that they needed to ask, like Ellis asked. And to ask these questions is to ask a question about how God is in the process of reversing the order of existing things. Because it's not obvious. It's not clear. It was not clear for those people then under the thumb of the Roman Empire. It was not obvious or abundantly clear what God was doing in the world. So Jesus told parables to get them to sort of wake up, to shake them up, to get them to ask questions about what God was doing and reversing the order of existing things, to get them to understand that with God, it is better to be humble than powerful. to get them to understand that with God, it is those who are most devalued under the empire, pushed to the edges, crushed underneath, that with God they are the most valuable and the most centered. That while there are those that may exclude and push away from God's table, he told parables so that people would understand those very folks that are pushed away and marginalized, they are front and center in the work that God is doing. That it is better to be humble and compassionate and powerless than rich and powerful and in control. And to do this, he tells them parables to get them to say, wait, what? What exactly does that mean for us here today? Now, sometimes when I tell you those parables, I have to do some work. I've got to tell you, well, historically, this is what this meant. And so this is how we will hear it the way that they would hear it, to get us to sort of reach that crisis moment of saying, like, what exactly is Jesus saying here? This parable is not one of those. It's done that work for us. It's really, really obvious if you had any sense of confusion when we heard this parable read, if you thought, who in the world is the good guy in this story? Good, you've already done your work. You're halfway there. Here's a story that has its question right at the surface for us. And here's what happens. It says that Jesus told his disciples this story. There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to the rich man that this manager was squandering his property. Right at the beginning, I gotta tell you two things, because you might be thinking, oh, okay, there's a rich guy, he's in charge. I know when there's someone in charge at the top of the power structure, that probably means God. No, no, no. Here's a little trick. They didn't teach me in the seminary, but I'm gonna pass it on to you. When the Bible, particularly the Gospel of Luke, mentions a rich man, and you might be prone to sort of think like, oh, it's the one with power. They must be talking about God here. Don't do it. Instead, just think, and I'm serious about this, Elon Musk. That's going to do your job for you right there, okay? All right? Can people be redeemed by God's work? Absolutely. But you got to start where it starts. I'm just telling you how it is. So Elon Musk had a manager, basically, right? And it says that charges were brought to him that the man was squandering his property. There's one little nuance here I got to tell you. It's the second thing. The word that says charges were brought to him, it's a little weird word in Greek. It can mean charges. It can also mean baseless allegations. There's a little wiggle room here. Jesus is already getting us to ask some questions. It might be that these are true allegations. It really might be that they're not true allegations. We don't know. We got to sit with the discomfort of that and see what happens. Well, this man, he calls this manager to him, who would have been responsible for working all of his accounts, making sure that everybody paid the interest of what the rich man had loaned. You're doing all of this work, this kind of go-between. And it says that the rich man called him and he summoned him to him and he says, what is this that I've heard about you? I need you to give me an account of your management, literally bring me the books where you manage my accounts and let me see it, because you can't be my manager any longer. And the manager says to himself, self, what am I going to do? Now that my master is taking this position away from me, I am not strong enough to dig. And as opposed to the hit from TLC in 1993, I am too proud to beg. Thank you, people that got that. My 90s folks are here. He's like, this is bad. I got nothing to do. This is the end. There's nothing I can figure out for this. It's a crisis moment. We don't know, did he really do something? Did he not really do something? We don't know. We don't know if we're supposed to identify with him in the situation or the rich man. We're not really sure who we're supposed to be pulling for at this moment. But we just know he's at this crisis moment of something has to happen. Now here's what happens. It says, I have decided what to do so that. In essence, what it's doing is it's saying past tense. It's better translated to say, I knew what to do so that when I was dismissed as manager, people would welcome me into their homes. He's likely saying something that he has already done to this point. Which means kind of the way the story unfolds is the rich man calls him and he's like, I'm going to let you go. This isn't going to work for us anymore. It's not going to happen. The guy says, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Irony, I figured this out a long time ago. I knew what to do. It's the twist. It's the moment that the listeners would have gone, oh, wait a minute. He wasn't actually scared. He had prepared for this moment, but in what way? Here's what he says. I knew what to do so that when I was one day dismissed as a manager, for right reasons or wrong, we don't know, he leaves it vague, people may welcome me into their homes. Okay, what people? Well, he tells us. Having summoned his master's debtors one by one, he began to ask them, how much do you owe my master? Well, I owe, 100 jugs of olive oil. And the manager is basically like, all right, I'm going to treat you like we grew up together. I want you to make it 50. I'll change it and you change it. There you go. We've just forgiven 50. Calls the next guy. What do you owe? 100 containers of wheat. It's a lot. I can barely keep up with it. All right, here's what we're going to do. You're going to take that bill and you're going to make it 80. And on he did this with every single debtor of the rich man. Now, some of this might have been his income. We don't know. Jesus leaves it frustratingly vague. But very likely so, it seems like he's cutting into his income when he does this. And he does this all the way down. Now, why does he do this? Why does he go to every single person and say to them, actually, I'm going to cut your debt? On one surface, on one hand, from one particular viewpoint, it looks like a really, really foolish thing to do, doesn't it? Cutting himself off at the knees. Is that the expression? Okay, that's weirdly violent. I'm sorry, I didn't have any other thing. Shoot yourselves in the foot. Okay, it's terrible. I don't have any good examples. He's doing something that works against his own interest, right? Why would he do this? What in the world does he have to gain all along this time in a system that is designed to send wealth up, debt down? Why all of a sudden does he, in the middle of that, start to reverse the order of existing things? Start to send money down, debt up. Why does he work in a system that is designed that every single person, for him and all of the debtors, they want to curry favor with the big rich guy up top, right? He's the one with the power. He's the one that's going to make things happen. He's the one with everything going for him. Why all of a sudden, midway through all of this system, does he do something that seems really, really foolish from the outside, which is that all of a sudden he begins to curry favor with those who are in need rather than those with the power and with the wealth? Why does he do such a thing? Well, seems like he's working to gain favor. Seems like he knows one day the system isn't going to hold. One day the relationship is going to end. One day it's going to be different. And he knows that one day the order of existing things is going to change for the rich man and for the debtors and for him. And what does he do? He starts to act like it's happening right now. He gets to work. To mix metaphors, he grabs a shovel and he starts digging. He starts to reverse the order of existing things before it happens because he knows that day is coming. He says, one day, I'm going to need favor from the people who are in need rather than from the folks up top with all the power. And so he sets to work at doing it because he knows one day, the river is going to flow the other direction. And then in the most confusing part out of what's already so confusing, here's what Jesus says. He says, and the master commended or applauded the manager because he had been so clever. What? It's like the rich man is like, you got me. You saw what was coming long before I did. You were working ahead. You're far more clever than I am. And then Jesus does this. He's told the story, and now with this little semicolon right here, after the word shrewdly there on the second line, he starts to give his own commentary about what the parable is supposed to mean. And we're ready for it, aren't we? Because we're wondering what's going on in this story. And Jesus says, "For the children of this age are far more clever in dealing with their own generation or their own time than are the children of light." Let me explain what that means. Jesus is in essence saying that people who engage in the systems of this world, sometimes radically unjust system, often unjust systems, particularly economics, they're far more clever and resourceful in how they're going to maximize their place and position in that system than the children of light, the church, the people that look and ask and wonder, what is God doing? What does God value? Who does God lift up? Who should we center? Than those children of light are in dealing with the same world. In other words, he says, there's people who are far more clever than are the children of light in the church. And wouldn't it be great if the people and children of light were just as clever? Now, we got to avoid two things here. Like any metaphor, it's imperfect. One thing that we have to avoid about this metaphor is saying that Jesus is saying this is exactly how the children of light and the church are supposed to act. Jesus is not saying that the way for the children of light to engage in the work of the kingdom is to engage in financial mismanagement. That's not what he's saying. It's a metaphor. He's sort of saying it's sort of like this in this sort of way. But here's the other side that we have to avoid, and it's always a trick. The other thing that we have to avoid is hearing that the man sort of engaged in this financial trickery of someone else's funds, possibly even theft, that there's nothing about him to speak to us in this story either. Okay? He tells a story about someone who does something. He does not lift him up completely in every single action, neither does he say that there's nothing that we can learn in this moment, all right? Again, we got to sit in that tension. But what Jesus is saying here is this. He's saying, in essence, that if in this world we can be so engaged in trying to get ahead, in being as clever as this manager, in trying to work the system for ourselves, if we can be that clever and that smart for our own purposes, for injustice even sometimes. He wants to ask a question. What if the church was just that clever in dealing with what God is doing? Not for our own purposes and not for our own reasons, but to witness to the coming kingdom of God. To witness to that moment, let her go, when the river starts to move the other way and the church was ready. Jesus uses an example of someone who is clever and smart and works hard and has a vision and a sense of hope to be able to do something for themselves and their future, to get us to ask ourselves, what if we did the same thing for God's future? Not in the same way, but with the same audacious hope, with the same cleverness and work, loving God with our heart, soul, mind, body, and strength, throwing ourselves into the work and witness of the world. I have never seen a flow of wealth and power and privilege upwards the way that we do right now. And I lived through Reagan, y'all. I'm full of old references today. But what we have going on today in the country of America is a flow of wealth, power, and privilege up. It makes our heads spin. It's hard to name it. It's one thing after another, after another, after another. Tariffs hurt at the grocery. If you're wealthy, you don't notice it. If you're in need and you're counting every single dime, like so many of us are, it hurts you the most. There is a flow of power from news corporations, from tech bros, healthcare, and what are they doing? They're all clamoring for the favor of the rich man up top. Sometimes the parables don't need any metaphor or translation because it's so real. Thank you, Star. And when the world is like that, it can look like foolishness to ask some questions, can it? It can look different. But what I can't help but think when Jesus tells this story is, what if the children of light were just as full of audacious hope and cleverness and work as are the children of this age and time? What would that look like? To start digging before the river reverses course. I tell you what it looks like. It looks a lot like this. It looks a lot like you. It looks a lot like us. It looks a lot like this. It looks like the early church. It looks like those who are really, really concerned about what's happening in the country today. And it looks like people that come together, brave terrible parking on a Sunday morning, because you're ready for the gospel. You're ready for the good news. You need hope. So you come together and you put your money together and you fill a community fridge and you make sure that it's full for people who need it. And you give money to our community fund. It's there for anyone. Y'all, if you ever need money, you apply to the community fund. That's what it's there for. It's there for those times when we need help. You give and you take. That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like to be clever as the children of light in these situations. It looks like a church like ours, and I'm bragging on you right now, that says we are going to center the people who are most marginalized and attacked today by those in power. We're going to value you. We're going to value them. We're going to send power and favor down rather than up. It looks like a church that does all of these things. It looks like a church that's going to talk about what's going on. And I know it's hard. I know there's going to be weeks where we need to just have a break, and we will have that. But to be the children of light and to be resourceful and clever and to work hard and to be hopeful, it means we got to tell the truth on Sunday mornings and find hope in that. It is my hope for us that we understand what God is doing in our lives, in this church, what it looks like when we recognize and know that God is working in us, in you, that something is happening, that one day the system will not hold. So let's work on it now. Let's, in small and clever and wondrous and audacious ways, work to reverse the order of existing things today. In how we live and act, use our money, witness, pray, and worship. Because we're getting ready for what's coming. And we don't just do it because it's smarter for us in the end. We do it because it's love. We do it because it's the right thing. We do it because you matter. You matter. Those who are dissenters and feel targeted, you matter. Immigrants, Asylum seekers, you matter. You're valuable. You're centered. Queer community, you matter. You are here. People of color, educators, you matter. You matter. God is for you. It is my great, great hope to tell you the parables, to give you the gospel, and then to just say, let her go. What will you do this week? How will you be clever this week in how you reverse the order of existing things? It might be a moment. It might be one thing that you do. It might be a prayer that you pray. It might be who you work, reach out to. It might be so many things. Whatever you do, remember, 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 God is at work in you.